The following podcast is sponsored by Financial Sense Wealth Management. To learn more about our investment services, go to financialsense.com or give us a call at 888-486-3939. This is the Financial Sense News Hour. Now, here's the Financial Sense News Team.
It was a good week for investors as the NASDAQ and the S&P 500 made fresh new highs this week. This week's robust gains followed last week's losses, which were the worst setback for the market since last October. The market's responding to massive fiscal spending, with Congress reaching an agreement on a $1 trillion infrastructure bill that could be followed by an additional spending bill of up to $4 trillion. Hi, everyone. I'm Jim Poplava, and welcome to this week's Financial Sense News Hour. On deck is Art Hill from Trend Investor Pro. Art sees the markets heading higher, with real estate and energy powering higher. Later on in the program, Ryan Sweet from Moody's Economics will join me as we look at economic growth that we have not seen since the Johnson era. Ryan is in the camp that the current wave of inflation is transitory. You'll want to listen as to why. But first, let's find out what moved the markets this week with Ryan Poplava.
Another week in the financial markets, another debate on inflation, transitory or not. This week, the inflationary camp won from Monday through Friday. The main drivers this week were the technical bounce for the reflationary camp from oversold conditions, positive comments from Chair Powell on employment being strong in the fall, the unveiling of a bipartisan infrastructure framework at $1.2 trillion, and finally, inflationary data combined with a positive showing in the Fed's latest stress tests that could pave the way towards share buybacks and dividends that helped lift financials. So let's get into the weeds on these subjects. In a technical bounce that got some momentum from the S&P 500 after it reclaimed its 50-day moving average on Monday, some of the hardest-hit areas in cyclicals and financials rallied on no significant news, with the biggest gains in energy, financials, industrials, and materials. At the same time, the Treasury yield curve, which gave back some of its flattening trends from last week, did steepen a bit. The 2-year Treasury stayed at 0.27% from last week, while the 10-year climbed 9 basis points to end the week at 1.54%. Some more positive momentum in stocks came from comments from Fed Chair Powell to Congress Tuesday, who said the Fed will not preemptively raise rates in response to fears of inflation, and that the factors contributing to both high unemployment and high inflation are transitory, and expects job creation will be strong in the fall. Now, Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen and Fed President Bostic echoed these views the following day on Wednesday. Thursday, the news that the White House unveiled a bipartisan infrastructure plan for about $1.2 trillion sent the S&P 500 and the NASDAQ to set intraday and closing record highs. The deal is far short of the one unveiled in March for about $2.25 trillion, but is said to include about 2/3 of the resources proposed in Biden's American Jobs Plan. That includes about $579 billion in new spending. Now, the news came as President Biden announced a group of senators from both sides of the aisle agreed to the terms. But of course, this will need to go to a vote. Judging by the reaction in stocks, the deal is a positive one towards aiding in the recovery effort, yet still draws some criticism for not sticking to traditional infrastructure items. Lastly, the inflationary data on Friday, which caused long-term rates to rise just a bit, coupled with positive stress tests on financial companies by the Fed, led to a strong showing in the S&P 500 financial sector, which rose 1.3% and about 5.25% for the week after last week's deep losses. Specifically, personal income decreased about 2% month over month in May, while the PCE price index component jumped 0.4%, which takes it to about 3.9% year over year. The core number, stripping out a few measures, was also up 0.5% and 3.4% year over year. While the numbers continue to be staggering, and though the 10-year rose, it didn't rise sharply, and short-term rates remained roughly unchanged, and the dollar only rose slightly. The interpretation is that investors are still anticipating better inflationary numbers in the months ahead. We'll see, of course, because that's not the trend yet. Still, financials were able to rally on the steepening of the yield curve combined with positive news on the Fed stress test for financial companies, paving the way for increases in share buybacks and or dividend payments. So to sum up things here, again, the reflationary camp in energy, financials, materials, and industrials regained some lost ground from last week's losses on a technical bounce and assurance from the Fed that they will not preemptively raise interest rates ahead of inflation. And the S&P 500 and the NASDAQ took to new all-time highs on the great news of a bipartisan infrastructure deal in the making and a view from the Fed that employment will be strong in the fall. That's it for this week's wrap-up. Jim, back to you.
The greatest bottlenecks that we're seeing right now is what's happening with the NTN. Many people probably do not know, but there was a COVID outbreak, another one in southern China. And because of that outbreak, China effectively shut down the fourth largest port in the world. 90% of all the world's electronics come from that port. So you've got everything from Walmart, Home Depot, Williams-Sonoma, Tesla, many, many companies that are exposed because this port was shut down.
If you want to listen to this full interview, go to financialsense.com and click the subscribe button.
Is your portfolio prepared for higher inflation? Don't let higher inflation erode the value of your hard-earned wealth. Let us put our financial expertise to work for you. Contact Financial Sense Wealth Management today at 888-486-3939 or email us at grow@financialsense.com. Advisory services offered through Financial Sense Advisors, Inc., a registered investment advisor. Securities offered through Financial Sense Securities, Inc., member FINRA SIPC. Both companies doing business as Financial Sense Wealth Management.
Well, the stock market is back in rally mode. However, sectors are changing where money is flowing. Let's find out what's happening here. Joining me on the program from Trend Investor Pro is Art Hill. Art, let's take it from the top. There was a period of time where we saw a correction in the technology sector, especially the NASDAQ. You saw the Dow breaking out. All that seems to have flipped now. So let's begin there.
Sure. Yeah, it all started really for technology. It started in the middle of May when technology bottomed and shot up, and you've got software breaking out, IGV, the software ETF breaking out of a big triangle. You've got the cybersecurity ETF hitting a new high. You got XLK, QQQ hitting new highs. And then if we go back a little bit further in March is when you had things like IWM starting to stall. IWM's gone, small caps have gone nowhere since March. And that was right around the time when the 10-year peaked as well. And maybe banks are also thrown into that group, as banks are a big part of the small cap indexes and ETFs, financial services. But, you know, KRE, regional banks have gone nowhere since March. And the 10-year has kind of worked its way lower from like 1.75 to 1.5%. So maybe that is affecting this rotation, is the fact that the 10-year moved down and some of these names in finance and industrials and these metals plays, commodity plays, except for oil, of course, have moved down along with the 10-year.
Let's just sidetrack for a moment. I want to go to commodities because gold and silver, copper were leading the commodities rush, especially if we look back over the last 4 or 5 months. And energy was a laggard. That is completely flipped now, where you have oil prices now over $70 a barrel. Copper is correcting. Gold and silver sold off. So let's talk about commodities briefly.
Yeah. You know, gold just does not have that good looking of a chart. You know, it peaked way back in August of 2020, and it got back above its 200-day for a few weeks in May, June, and then plunged right back below its 200-day. So gold is really one of the uglier charts out there, if you will. And if you compare that to, say, oil, you know, oil had this big move up with the stock market, of course, in early November until the end of February, and then kind of consolidated and then broke out in the latter part of May to new highs. So it has a much, say, cleaner uptrend where you're moving higher, you're consolidating, you're moving higher, whereas gold has just kind of been moving lower in a more volatile fashion. And then, yeah, copper definitely took a hit recently, and it's below its 50-day, but, you know, it's still in an uptrend. You know, spot copper was down in the low $2 area in March 2020, and it was pushing the $4.80, $4.90 area in early May without much of a correction along the way. And so this is the first decent correction that copper has had. And I think it's coming into support, or it's already bouncing off in that, you know, $4, $4.10 area. So copper looks much more constructive than, say, gold. Gold is the worst of those three.
And speaking of gold and commodities, we saw gold and silver going up. We saw the cryptos going up. Let's talk about cryptocurrencies. I mean, oh my goodness. Everybody was really excited with Bitcoin up at 58,000, but look where it's at now. I mean, that's the thing about some of these cryptos. When they correct, they're massive.
Yeah, that is true. And when they do correct, it can last a little while. It can last up to a year. If you look at the, you know, the last bubble, if you will, in crypto in 2017 into 18, it peaked there in the latter part of 2017, December. And then it declined all the way for pretty much all of 2018, and then started bottoming in 2019, had a big run up, didn't exceed that high from 2017, but then corrected from the summer of 2019 until it was around a year, until, you know, the early part of spring of 2020. And now we got this big move. But if I look at Bitcoin in particular, which is the one I've been talking about because it's got the most history and it's the most popular. But Bitcoin, you know, it's broken down. It's below its 200-day. Its 50-day is below its 200-day. So it looks to me like that decline we had into the May low broke the back of the bulls. And then it kind of consolidated. It's been consolidating now in the 30,000 to 40,000 area. But I would probably consider that a consolidation within a downtrend after breaking the bulls back and maybe get another leg lower. I would think I would want to sell into that 38,000, 40,000 area.
And we're also seeing, you know, not just a change in some of the major indexes, but let's talk about some of the subsectors in the S&P. We've got consumer discretionary, I guess, is doing okay. But if we've gone to sort of a safety somewhat trade in some of the stuff, selling off the, let's say, the inflation trade, doesn't seem to be showing up. I mean, we've got normally when you see interest rates go down or the bond market yields drop, you see also consumer staples. In other words, the safety trade. So sort of a mixed bag here.
Yeah, I think this is maybe one of these times more than ever when you have to focus on the actual chart that you're trading. You know, if I look at consumer staples, it's not supposed to be exciting. But, you know, it had a big surge off the March low in March 2020. And it's just been working its way higher in a fairly boring manner. And, you know, it hit a new high just a few weeks ago in early June. And it's pulling back from that high. So, you know, it's still a constructive chart overall. It's just not as strong as, say, technology. And then utilities, which would be kind of, you know, the bond proxy, if you will, they've kind of just gone flat. So they don't look very good in that regard. They've gone nowhere basically since October 2020. And you can't blame it all on interest rates because, you know, REITs have just gone berserk in 2021 with the XLRE moving from like 35 to 45. So REITs are also, you know, supposed to be these bond proxies, but they're performing quite well, but utilities aren't. And staples are still chugging along, grinding higher.
Yeah, because when you look at some of these sectors, communication services is still in a strong uptrend. If you look at healthcare, that's in a strong uptrend. If you look at energy, likewise. But some of the inflationary trades outside of energy don't look as well. Like you have materials breaking down. And as we talked about, some of these commodities, a lot of this was triggered or came after the Fed made an announcement that they may be raising interest rates sooner than expected. But it looks like there's been a damper put on the inflation trade.
Yeah, maybe it got ahead of itself. Maybe there was an overshoot. You know, in May, everybody was talking about inflation, and this is not transitory. This is going to last. And you flash forward here to the latter part of June, and now there's more talk that it's transitory. And of course, we're never going to know, and I'm not going to weigh in on that because it's really not my specialty if this inflation is transitory or not. But if you look at the XLB, the materials sector, it's like 50% chemical stocks, I believe. You know, it's still in an uptrend overall. It's moved below its 50-day moving average, but it's done that several times since, say, September 2020. And it is up from, well, just from 2020 here. You know, it started around 70, and it got to around 90. So it's okay for it to have a pullback within an uptrend. I think this is more of a corrective phase than a major trend reversal that we're seeing in materials and finance and industrials, the three sectors, the big sectors that have been hit the hardest over the last few weeks.
I want to spend a little time on real estate because, as you mentioned, the REITs have just been on fire this year. And up until recently, it's been the home builders as well. I mean, you know, real estate prices are up, what, 23% year over year. Home builders can't seem to build enough. There's just a shortage of housing. What's your take on the home builders?
I'm still constructive on the home builders. ITB hit a new high there in early part of May, May 10th. And it's below its 50-day, but it looks like this is a correction within a bigger uptrend because the 50-day is above the 200-day. Price is well above the 200-day. And I think ITB just kind of got a little bit ahead of itself after a run from, say, 55-ish at the beginning of the year to 77. And there is a certain ebb and flow in the markets. And these pullbacks, I think, we have to view them as opportunities more than threats when the bigger trend is up. And I still think we're in a bull market. The bigger trend is up for ITB. And so I think this pullback is more of an opportunity than a threat.
Yeah, if you look at real estate, I don't know what it's like in Europe, but here in the United States, Art, you put a house up for sale, it's sold in a couple of days. Instead of getting your asking price, there's a bidding war going on. And it's occurring in California, believe it or not, as expensive as it is here. It's in Vegas, it's in Phoenix, it's in Texas, it's in Florida. I mean, I've never seen anything like this in the real estate market where it's definitely a seller's market. When you put your house up for sale, it's sold in a couple of days and you get a premium.
Yeah, I've got family in Austin and family that's in the real estate business. And yeah, it is that crazy. You know, you put a bid on a house and of course you don't put it a couple thousand above the ask, you know, a couple tens of thousands above, and you're not the high bid. And they're just selling like hotcakes. And we're not talking central Austin. You know, we're talking they're not even suburbs anymore. They're more like smaller cities that have sprouted up around Austin over the years. Buda, for example, the housing prices there. But I think it's here in Europe too. Housing prices here in Belgium they're also at peaks. And it is definitely a seller's market here as well.
So, you know, as you look at real estate, you look at lumber prices, as you look at this sort of inflation trade that we had going into this recent correction, you had lumber prices going up, copper prices, energy prices, which are still going up. But, you know, everything from gold, silver, everything was sort of inflation oriented. That sort of pullback. So do you think this is just a pullback or in an upward trend, or where do we go from here?
Well, I think when you look at, like we talked about housing, I think that's a pullback within an uptrend. Materials, I think that's a pullback within an uptrend. I think some of the metals like copper and stuff, there might be some other issues at work, maybe with emerging markets, maybe with China. So I would hold off a little bit on those and let the dust settle. But I also see technology getting these huge breakouts across the board. You know, I track over a dozen technology-related ETFs, and they're breaking out of these triangles that extended from February to May. And with these big moves over the last 6 weeks or so, they've got these major breakouts working. Now, sure, they're short-term, they're quite extended and ripe for a rest or a pullback. But I think these are major bullish continuation breakouts that we've seen in, say, software. Semiconductors, not yet. They're challenging resistance. But cybersecurity is another one that has broken out. So there's still leadership there.
So let's move on to another trend that we're spotting on the market. That's the kind of green type stocks, whether you're looking at wind, solar, those kind of stocks. And, you know, going along with that, I would think copper. But what's your take on green investments here?
Well, I was just writing about two green ETFs today, the ICLN, which is the iShares Global Clean Energy ETF, and the PBW, which is the Winter Hill Clean Energy ETF. And these things had obscene advances from the March lows until the February highs. The Winter Hill Clean Energy ETF, PBW, was up like 500%. And it's the bigger they are, the harder they fall. We've all heard that one before. And I think it's the same with these high flyers. The higher they fly, the harder, the deeper they're going to correct. And so PBW fell like 48% or something from its high. But it still looks like a correction, albeit a massive correction, within a bigger uptrend. And now it's trying to get back above its 200-day. So there might be something constructive here with clean energy working now.
So as you look at this market and you track ETFs and money flows, what is looking good to you from an investment perspective as you look at these charts?
Well, from an investment perspective, I would still be in with the housing, the ITB. I would still be in with the materials, the XLB. I'm not too keen on banks or commodities just yet again. And I'm also semiconductors, I think, because I look at the stocks and it's got a big consolidation within an uptrend. And it looks like it's poised to break out and continue that uptrend. So I'd also like semiconductors as well.
So right now we have the NASDAQ breaking out. The S&P is looking good. The Dow looks like it's, I don't know, maybe consolidating. What about the big blue chip stocks? Would you be a buyer here?
Well, you know, these broader indexes like the S&P 500, they're kind of caught in the middle of this rotationary trade. So it's kind of like a seesaw where, you know, you have techs going up and then you have industrials, materials, and finance going down. And so that's what causes this kind of grind higher. And for the Dow, it's kind of similar. You know, the Dow peaked in May 10th and has been going flat ever since. So I think you need to go a level down to either the sector or the industry group level to really put a trade on rather than these broader indexes that are caught in this rotational. They're going to grind higher. I don't see any structural problems with the S&P 500 other than we saw a percentage above the 50-day moving average, the percentage of stocks in the S&P above the 50-day moving average take a big hit, but it didn't hit a critical level like below 30% or even below 20%. And I think that was because of weakness in finance and industrials. Those two sectors have over 60 stocks each in them. They're two of the bigger sectors. But I think this kind of rotation is causing these broader indexes to do more grinding and less trending, if you will.
So if you had money to put to work right now, where would you put it and what would you avoid?
Well, I would do housing, ITB. I would do materials, XLB. I would do semiconductors, SOSX. I like cybersecurity as well. It's breaking out. And I'm going to stay away right now with the stay away from the banks, the finance sector. I think REITs are a bit overbought, so I'm not wanting to chase those. I would stay away from utilities because they're showing some relative weakness right now, and just let them find their footing later on and see. But right now, I think the winners, I would favor ITB and materials and SOCs and cyber.
All right. Well, listen, Art, as we close, why don't you tell investors about your Trend Investor Pro services and what they might find there?
Sure, absolutely. So the website is trendinvestorpro.com. And if you go to that website and you click on the analysis button page at the top, there's a combination of free and premium articles, and the free articles are available to everybody. And I just put out a summer reading list, which has a dozen books that have influenced me over the years that I think could help other traders and investors. And so I specialize mostly in ETFs, and I have a broad market timing model based on a number of breadth indicators and some price indicators for the S&P 500, and it's currently bullish. So the market regime is bullish, and it's been that way for just over a year. And then I try to find bullish setups within ETFs that are already in uptrend. So like ITB, these pullbacks within an uptrend, these pullbacks that look healthy. And that is a specialty of trendinvestorpro.com.
All right. Well, listen, Art, as always, it's a pleasure speaking with you. Stay safe and come back again.
Thanks for having me, Jim. Take care, bud.
You recently wrote a really interesting article talking about what the batteries of the future are going to look like, and you cited the work of some of the world's leading materials scientists. Can you tell us what they're working on and how this differs from nearly every battery being used today?
For about the past decade, a group of researchers, primarily in Europe, have been working on something that they call a structural battery, which is taking the idea of a conventional, say, lithium-ion battery and totally rethinking how it's actually used to power a device or a car. And their idea is basically to turn the battery into a structural element of the thing that it's powering. So instead of becoming what one of the researchers describes as a parasite, the battery is actually contributing mechanical strength to, say, a car. So it's actually embedded in the structure of the car itself, rather than as a discrete battery pack like you might find in the floor of a Tesla, for example.
If you want to listen to this full interview, go to financialsense.com and click the subscribe button.
Financial Sense Wealth Management has been named as one of the top investment advisory firms in the U.S. by the Financial Times. Let us put our financial expertise to work for you. Call now at 888-486-3939 or email grow at financialsense.com. Advisory services offered through Financial Sense Advisors, Inc., a registered investment advisor. Securities offered through Financial Sense Securities, Inc., member FINRA SIPC. Both companies doing business as Financial Sense Wealth Management.
Well, with the economy booming, how long will this boom continue? Well, let's find out. Joining us on the program from Moody's Analytics is Ryan Sweet. And Ryan, we saw first quarter GDP come in at an annual rate of 6.4%. We've got a lot of stimulus that's going to hit this economy, $900 billion carryover from the Trump administration, $1.9 trillion from Biden's passage beginning of the year. Where do we go from here, and how strong will this economic recovery be?
Well, the economy is booming, as you mentioned, and it's going to continue to boom for at least the next 2 to 3 years. You know, first quarter GDP was strong, 6-7%. Second quarter is going to be even better. Our high frequency GDP model, which basically is a bean counting approach, takes all the source data that feeds into GDP, has it up over 10% annualized in the second quarter. Every part of the economy, for the most part, is doing really well. Consumer spending is being supported by the fiscal stimulus, improvement in the job market. Housing has softened a little bit, but you know, home sales are still, you know, noticeably stronger than what we saw throughout the last expansion. Business investment is strong. This economy is going to take a lot to derail this recovery. And, you know, unlike past recoveries, this one is going to be accelerated, meaning that we'll get back to full employment by the end of next year. Whereas, you know, after the Great Recession, financial crisis, it took us almost 10 years to fully heal from that downturn.
So when you look at some of the major indexes, the manufacturing, the ISM report, it's looking very, very strong. A lot of this economic recovery is also being predicated on the fact that consumers have a lot of money. I think you know this figure probably off hand, is the savings rate has gone up considerably. So there's a lot of pent-up savings. The question is, Ryan, do consumers spend it?
They will. The American consumer doesn't like to save that much. And when you look at probably the key metric that we're focused on is excess savings. So this is the amount of savings above and beyond, you know, what consumers had, you know, pre-COVID, so 2019. And this excess savings is, you know, forced savings. So consumers couldn't go out to restaurants, bars, movie theaters. That spending that would have occurred is now ending up in savings. And by our calculations, the U.S. consumer has about $2.5 trillion in excess savings. Now, that's going to get into the economy at some point. The timing is questionable. Most likely it starts trickling out fourth quarter of this year as the U.S. achieves this herd resiliency, which, in other words, enough people are vaccinated where everyone feels comfortable going back out and, you know, getting back to normal. So getting on planes, going to restaurants, going to movie theaters. And in 2022, we'll see a lot more of that excess savings being drawn down. So $2.5 trillion is a lot of support for the economy that's going to, you know, begin to impact the economy over the next, you know, couple of years.
What about these new programs? In addition to almost $3 trillion of stimulus, they're talking about, you know, who knows where this bill's going to end up, anywhere from $1 trillion to $2 trillion on infrastructure, and then another $2 trillion on America's Family Act. So you're talking about another $4 trillion coming down into this economy. I guess, number one, can they actually pass this and have shovel-ready projects that can help this economy along? Because I think back, Ryan, to the Obama years with the $900 billion stimulus, a lot of those shovel-ready projects weren't shovel-ready.
Exactly. There's no such thing as a shovel-ready project. And the infrastructure package, you know, pinpointing the exact amount that's going to get passed is difficult. Our assumption is we get something close to $1.5 trillion. It's done via the reconciliation process. Now, that anytime you're doing infrastructure spending, that affects the economy with a pretty long lag. Again, getting back to the idea that there's really not many or any shovel-ready projects. So that affects the economy over the next, you know, 2, 3, 4, or 5 years. It's not necessarily going to have a big impact on the economy this year or next. But down the road, the infrastructure spending will really pay dividends for the economy in the short run by creating a lot of construction jobs, you know, boosting wages. But longer term, it's much more important because infrastructure can increase productivity. And productivity is, you know, has been very, very weak on average, you know, over the last, you know, 10, 15 years. So we get any boost that we can get to productivity will benefit the economy in the long run. It basically increases the speed limit that the economy can grow without generating inflationary pressures. Also, when productivity increases, people's living standards improve. So I think the infrastructure package is really, really important. I mean, I'm in Pennsylvania, drive on any major highway, go over any major bridge, and the needs for infrastructure are pretty glaring.
Yeah, we have potholes all over the place here in California. Let's talk about if this bill is passed, they want to pay for it by raising taxes, capital gains taxes, income taxes, estate taxes. What impact will that have on economic growth?
It will be a modest drag. I think it's important not to overdo the boost to the economy from reductions in taxes, and we don't want to overdo the drag from increasing them. You know, during the Trump administration, they cut the corporate tax rate. The idea was that that was going to create a lot of jobs. It was going to boost investment. And it really didn't. When you look at the investment details in the national income and product accounts, you really don't see a significant increase in business investment. Where you did see it, any growth in investment, it was in energy-related segments, and that was more attributed to higher global oil prices at the time rather than lower corporate tax rates. So I think reversing some because of the corporate tax cut that the Trump administration passed, you know, isn't going to have a huge effect on business investment. And then personal income taxes, they're going to only go up for the very well-to-do Americans. So we don't think that's going to have an enormous impact on consumer spending. And then the capital gains tax, I think where you'll see the initial impact is in the stock market. When you look back at past instances when the capital gains tax increased, you got a little bit of a correction in the stock market, you know, leading up to the new tax rate being implemented. But then after that, the stock market resumed rising. So it's hard to really tease out whether or not that had, you know, a significant, you know, longer term impact on equity markets.
So let's talk about something that's on the minds of many people in the market, and that is inflation. Now, the Fed has taken the position that a lot of the inflationary impulses that we're seeing right now are temporary and that will get back to normal. What's your view on inflation going forward?
Yeah, I would side with the Fed. I think, you know, I understand everyone's concern about inflation. We're seeing, you know, a significant acceleration in growth in producer prices, import prices, consumer prices. But there are a lot of transitory or temporary factors driving this. First, we're reopening an economy, and that is unleashing a lot of pent-up demand, not just for consumer services, but, you know, for other aspects of the economy. And that's creating some price pressures. But we only, hopefully, are only going to have to reopen the economy once. So as, you know, the next 6-12 months pass, that the reopening impact on inflation should begin to fade. Also, we have a lot of supply chain issues. Again, these are temporary. This is where you're getting a lot of cost push inflation. The global semiconductor chip shortage is a perfect example of this. That's driving up new vehicle prices. And then by extension, you know, people are going and looking at the used vehicle market. That's driving up used car prices. That will linger a little bit longer, you know, maybe into 2022. But by mid next year, a lot of these inflationary pressures that we're experiencing now will be dissipating. And we'll actually see inflation at or a little bit below the Fed's 2% objective by this time next year.
So if you look at this and maybe just short term, what about what's going on with the supply chain issue? I guess you're seeing a lot of these supply chains being reoriented, as we found out with the lockdowns, is so many things from pharmaceuticals to manufacturing parts are made in China, making it more difficult for companies to produce goods.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, that's getting back to one of the issues that we're seeing with not just, you know, inflation, but manufacturing in the U.S. is doing really well, but it would be doing much better if we didn't have, you know, some of these supply chain bottlenecks, you know, global container shortage. But again, I mean, this is, you know, some of it's attributed to that when countries began to loosen some of their COVID-related restrictions, businesses got caught flat-footed. They weren't expecting such a big increase in demand. I mean, you know, I was surprised how strong the U.S. housing market did right late last year, or second half of last year, and it's doing well this year. A lot of demand for construction, home improvement, that drove up a lot of construction costs, including lumber. And then, you know, businesses just weren't able to meet the demand, and we're, you know, experiencing some shortages in a number of commodity markets, looking at copper and lumber in particular.
So when you take a look at what's going on with real estate, you know, I think prices are up 16% year over year. And then you have, of course, what we've seen happen with lumber costs and things like that. I was really surprised, Ryan, that despite all these increases in home prices, that demand remains as strong as it is, and that I think I was reading somewhere there's a shortage of something like 5 million homes. So it sounds like the real estate market is going to remain strong in the next couple of years despite the price increases.
Yeah, so far, I mean, I think this is, you know, a fairly unhealthy housing market in the sense that demand's strong, but there's not enough inventory, not only just on the new home side. So builders are having a hard time, you know, keeping up with demand. They have labor supply constraints. Rising construction costs are problematic. Just the increase in lumber prices alone added, you know, and I think this is according to the National Association of Realtors, added $36,000 to the cost of a new home. But also finding buildable lots has been an issue for, you know, many years now. But on the existing home side, people are staying in their homes longer. So we have very lean existing home inventories. And that supply-demand imbalance is driving prices higher pretty quickly. I do think the increase in prices is starting to erode some affordability. But you know, I would agree with you that for the next few years, the housing market is going to be strong. We're not going to see 16% increase in house prices year in and year out. It's going to be much softer than that. But if you look at one of the key drivers of the housing market, it's demographics, and a large wave of the millennial generation is moving into their prime home buying years, which is typically in your early 30s. So we got a lot of demand that is going to support the housing market over the next several years.
So let's talk about the Fed. The Fed met and basically said, we may start raising interest rates much sooner, maybe the end of 2022 or 2023. What are the chances, Ryan, that they get this right? You know, anytime you saw last time when they raised it to what, 2.25, 2.5, they immediately started having an impact on the market and the economy, and then they quickly reduced it. What are the chances they can execute and start taper or raising interest rates without causing another or wreaking havoc with the economy and markets?
Yeah, I mean, the Fed's got a difficult task ahead of them in the sense that, you know, they're going to try to land the plane perfectly on the tarmac, and it's doable, but I mean, it's going to be a rocky landing. There's going to be some bumps along the way. We already saw it when they, you know, the dot plot, which shows, you know, FOMC participants' expectations for the appropriate path of short-term interest rates. Now they're looking at, you know, tightening in 2023, whereas before, you know, it was, you know, after 2023. That kind of rattled the bond market, rattled equity investors. And there's going to be some communication hiccups here and there. So I do think, you know, this isn't going to be perfect, but I do think the Fed's learned from the mistakes of the last recovery and that they're not going to raise interest rates prematurely. They're going to make sure that the economy is very close, if not at full employment, that we have inflation running slightly above their target before they start to normalize interest rates. Because I think the Fed can err on the side of waiting a little bit too long because they have all the tools that they need to clamp down on inflation, anchor inflation expectations if they become dislodged. So, and I think the Fed, their new policy framework, this average, flexible average inflation targeting, allows them to, you know, aim for a little bit above target inflation. And they also have adopted this, it's not officially in their mandate, but they want an all-inclusive recovery. Therefore, they want minority unemployment rates to get back down to where they were pre-pandemic. And that is going to occur. We're going to create a boatload of jobs, you know, this year, next year, and into 2023. So the labor market's going to be very, very strong. But I think the Fed's going to be patient. But once they begin to raise interest rates, they may have to go faster than what, you know, they have penciled into their forecast and what markets are anticipating.
So looking at all this, in your opinion, what could go wrong here?
Well, with regards to the Fed, they could misread the inflation backdrop. And all economists, we have to be humble when trying to forecast inflation. It's very, very difficult to forecast inflation with any confidence. But I do believe there's a lot of transitory factors boosting inflation. I mean, you can look at all the components of the consumer price index, and you see it in airfares, rental cars, lodging away from home, all things that are being boosted, prices being boosted by the reopening of the economy. But if we're wrong, and this isn't transitory, and inflation expectations become dislodged, that could create a lot of headaches for the Fed. They may have to raise interest rates more aggressively. And typically when the Fed, you know, tries to, you know, rather than gently applying their foot to the brake, when they have to slam their foot on the brake, that causes a lot of problems in financial markets. Financial market conditions will tighten suddenly. And that could, you know, take a lot of steam out of this recovery.
And what are some other things? And what I'm thinking about here, Ryan, what if we get a new strain or variant of COVID-19 that we aren't anticipating? Or, you know, there's some kind of geopolitical event. I'm thinking of the trade wars that was between the U.S. and China with the Trump administration. You know, I'm just thinking of outside the typical thinking, things that could happen that could disrupt everything.
Yeah, so high up on our list, we maintain this U.S. risk matrix. So, you know, kind of trying to visualize it, you know, what's the probability of this event occurring and what's the severity? So what's the economic cost of that event? Number one on our list, of course, is the pandemic. Pandemic isn't over. There are, you know, some variants that are proving to be an issue in other countries. So the path of the economy is still very closely tied to developments on the pandemic front, you know, daily confirmed cases, the vaccination progress, which, you know, the U.S. is doing really well on, better than other developed economies. So that's number one. If, you know, we have to tighten restrictions, or if states have to go back into lockdown, for example, you know, that would have enormous economic costs. Other things that are on our list, you know, I think are tied to financial markets, in the sense that, kind of looking at different valuation metrics, the stock market seems to be, you know, pretty frothy. You know, by our calculations, it's probably 15 to 20% overvalued. And typically when you get a stock market correction, you know, the economy can weather that. But if you get a correction that's, you know, 20% and is, you know, much more persistent, that, in other words, the market doesn't bounce back, the economic cost can escalate quite quickly. But again, going back to our earlier discussion, we're talking about an economy that's, you know, going to be growing 5-6% over the next couple of years. The shock that would push us into the economy is going to have to be, you know, enormous, or it's going to have to be a perfect storm where you get a stock market correction, the Fed making a policy error. Another thing high up on our list is DC, you know, Congress. If there's a sudden shift to fiscal austerity, in other words, they go from, you know, boosting government spending to trying to rein it in because there are concerns about deficits, debt, that would, you know, slow the recovery. They made the same mistake after the Great Recession. They prematurely shifted from, you know, accommodative fiscal policies to contractionary or restrictive. And that really weighed on the economy. So hopefully they don't make that shift too soon this time around.
So outside of that, let's say a breakout of a new variant of COVID or some geopolitical event, you think this economy can hum along at probably some of the best growth rates we've seen in years?
I do. I mean, it's not going to be the strongest growth on record, but it's going to be among the best growth that we've seen since the early 1980s. And at least this year, the U.S. could be or post the strongest growth of any country. The Chinese economy is slowing. Europe is, you know, still struggling, getting their arms around the pandemic and, you know, increasing vaccinations. But the U.S. is off and running. This is going to be a booming economy for the next couple of years, which is, you know, going to be very beneficial to the labor market. We're, you know, right now we have, according to the JOLTS data, there's more than 9 million open positions. And we'll be able to fill those very, very quickly once we start to address some of the labor supply constraints. And, you know, tops on that list is healthcare concerns and childcare issues. And that's all tied to the pandemic. So hopefully once more schools are open next school year, we'll be able to pull a lot more people in the labor force, and you're going to see a job market that is red hot.
So at least for the foreseeable future, for the end of this year and probably the next year or two, you expect strong economic growth. And I suspect sooner or later, we'll probably get a correction. But as long as that correction doesn't become a large one, like in the 15, 20% range, things should hum along nicely.
It should. The economy's got a lot of fiscal support behind it and monetary support, monetary policy. So it's really going to take, you know, an enormous shock to derail this recovery over the next couple of years. So we're going to see, you know, very strong economic growth. We're going to see an unemployment rate that's coming down very, very quickly. We're going to see the prime age labor force participation rate continuing to climb. So from an economic perspective, we should, you know, fully heal from this pandemic and recession by late next year, early 2023.
All right. Well, listen, Ryan, as we close, why don't you tell our listeners about all the work that you guys do? You not only cover extensive economic data here in the U.S., but globally as well.
We do for our Economic View platform, which is our real-time economic analysis and data website. We cover 300 global economic indicators. These are key indicators that we keep close tabs on to, you know, kind of get a sense of how the global economy and regional economies are performing. We also have daily notes on, you know, the global economy, financial markets. And recently, we started a new podcast, Inside Economics. So that's been a lot of fun. I participated in it with our chief economist, Mark Zandi, and our deputy chief economist, Chris DeRitas.
All right, super. Well, listen, give out the website if you would.
It is economy.com.
All right. Well, listen, Ryan, thanks so much for joining us on the program. Have a great rest of the summer and come back again.
That concludes our weekend edition of the Financial Sense News Hour. To speak with our financial planning and wealth advisory team, which has been servicing clients for over 35 years,
feel free to give us a call at 888, that's 888-486-3939. Also, don't forget to tell your friends and family about our podcast, Financial Sense NewsHour, to stay on top of the latest developments in the market and how they impact your investments. Lastly, if you aren't already a subscriber and would like to listen to more of our premium content airing 3 days during the week through our website or through an app on your mobile device, go to financialsense.com and click the subscribe button. On behalf of Financial Sense NewsHour and the Financial Sense Wealth Management team, we hope you have a pleasant weekend.
The Financial Sense NewsHour is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the NewsHour each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of the Financial Sense staff and do not take into account listener suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Financial Sense NewsHour and its parent company shall not be liable for any financial losses that result from investing in any companies mentioned in Financial Sense or arising out of the use of any material on the NewsHour. Be advised that you invest at your own risk.